The word is not just a series of sounds, that it is a matter of the ideas that God wants to give us. One thing I tried to bring out yesterday, but perhaps did not make altogether clear, is that a word-for-word translation is an impossibility. Every translation is to some extent a paraphrase. Now, if you simply look at a book and try to decide what it means and then express it in your own language, that is a paraphrase. And of course, a really thoroughgoing paraphrase gives what you think the original means, but gives no one any way of checking on whether what you think is right. A word-for-word translation gives somebody a way of checking if he knows the original language. Then you might as well use the original language in the first place. A word-for-word translation makes no sense to somebody that doesn't know the original language. So every translation is to some extent a paraphrase. But a translation has two purposes. A translation should have impact. It should take an idea and get it into people's minds. It should hold them. It should seize them with these ideas that are to be presented. Now, a paraphrase can be far more effective than a translation for this purpose. But a translation also has an equally important purpose of taking certain ideas and making them available so that you can study and decide for yourself what the original means. And from that viewpoint, the less of paraphrase is necessary, the nearer it comes, up to a certain point, the nearer it comes being something that someone can study for himself and perhaps get ideas from it that were in the original, but that were not grasped by the person who made the paraphrase or the translation. Then toward the end of the hour, we looked at a book that was presented 25 years ago with tremendous acclaim, the New Revised Standard Version, which its authors thought would replace the King James Version. And I wouldn't be surprised if in a great many churches it has replaced the King James Version. I doubt if in many of the churches with which the people here are connected, they are, the Revised Standard Version is the text that is used. But I wouldn't be surprised if there were more churches today, or a larger number of people attending churches that for public reading are using the RSV than are using any other particular version. So it is certainly important that we be aware of that. I wouldn't try to lead somebody away from one of the churches on the ground of the errors of the RSV. There are far greater and more important grounds. It's far better for one to read the RSV than for him not to read the Bible at all. Far better. The RSV New Testament is on the whole quite a good translation. These men, not perhaps believing anything that the New Testament writers believed, thinking it was a lot of mythology, nevertheless, had a book in which there was clearly stated what those queer people of 2,000 years ago believed. And they had a key in putting that into pretty good English. And let's spend a lot of time arguing with somebody who is approaching Christianity as to whether he should use the RSV. I would encourage him to read it and study it, and he can get from it the way of salvation. But when you take the RSV New Testament and put it together with the Old Testament and call the whole thing a Holy Bible, that's a misnomer. Because the RSV New Testament repeatedly says that certain things happened because they were predicted in the Old Testament, and then you turn to the RSV Old Testament and you find an entirely different statement. And you cannot carefully read the New Testament and investigate the footnotes if you have no other background, without coming to the conclusion that the New Testament writers were either fools or knaves to so misinterpret the Old Testament. So we noticed last time that the New Testament says that a virgin shall conceive. This is why Mary, this is proof that Mary was not a dissolute woman, but was actually fulfilling what was predicted in the Old Testament, as the angel pointed out. But you look at the Old Testament, in the RSV, and it just says, a young woman. Now, I don't know how much time I want to take on the RSV today. I have many other important things. But I want to call your attention to a few errors of this type in it. And don't think of them just as examples of errors in the RSV. Think of them also as questions, as illustrations of the problems of translation. Because they are very vital from that viewpoint as well as from the viewpoint of errors in the RSV. And by the way, if anyone wants to go further into this, I wrote a little pamphlet in which I discussed a good many of these matters 25 years ago, and the American Council of Christian Churches has sent out thousands of copies of it. You could easily, I believe, still get copies of it from them if you should want. But now I want to call your attention to the second psalm. And in the RSV, it says, serve the Lord with fear, with trembling, kiss his feet. The King James says, kiss the Son, lest he be angry. This says, kiss his feet. Well, now there's no way that you can get feet out of the word bar. Absolutely no way. And they have a footnote here which just says that Hebrew is uncertain. Well, what is certain is that they're not using a Hebrew word there. They're using an Aramaic word. The ordinary Hebrew word for son is ben. But the word bar is an Aramaic word. And the Hebrews and the Aramaic-speaking people were very much mixed together. Aramaic was the common language of commerce. And in fact, at the time of the exile, the Hebrews stopped talking Hebrew, merely used it as a sacred language and taught Aramaic entirely. So this word bar for son was certainly intelligible to all of them. And we do find it in one place in the Proverbs where it is simply used in place of men. So there's no reason anybody should have difficulty in understanding that this means kiss the son, even though the ordinary word for son is not used. But through the translators, they didn't see why the Messiah would be called a son. So they say, kiss his feet and put a footnote. The Hebrew is uncertain. In Zechariah 9:9, there is a statement, part of which is quoted in connection with the triumphal entry of the Lord into Jerusalem. I want to refer to a part of the statement that is not quoted in the this New Testament reference. It is Zechariah, the 9th chapter, where it says, verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Lo, your king comes to you. Triumphant and victorious is he, humble and riding on an ass, on a colt, the foal of an ass. Now that's a good way to describe a king coming, isn't it? Triumphant and victorious. But the King James says, just and having salvation. Now there's quite a change between just and having salvation and triumphant and victorious. Now a person may think that this doesn't make sense to say that Jesus is coming is going to be just and having salvation. It doesn't seem to me it would be so difficult to say that about a king. But evidently to these men it seemed impossible. This word that they translate triumphant, they translate just or righteous dozens of times in the RSV Old Testament. That is the meaning of the word, just or righteous. Well, now if a man is just, he is going to be vindicated if he's falsely accused. And therefore, if he's vindicated, he may be triumphant. So they get to the idea of triumphant. But they're not more than two or three cases out of a couple of hundred words where they translate triumphant. And then they say triumphant and victorious. Now there the problem's a little bit harder. The Hebrew, most literally, would be being saved. Triumphant just and being saved. Now you could take it as reflective, just and saving oneself. The King James translation, having salvation, is, I think, a pretty good guess. I'm not quite sure it's right. But it's rather near, certainly. But victorious, well, if you're saved, you're victorious, yes. But I don't think the word is ever translated victorious anywhere else. So I can't see any reason for their saying triumphant and victorious, except they want to get away from anything that sounds like the triumphal entry. Any translator is affected by his viewpoint. It is inevitable. And therefore, there is always danger in a translation that is made, as this one is, by men who, no matter how great scholars they may be, are definitely unbelievers as far as evangelical Christianity is concerned. And most of the translators would definitely fall in that category. A very interesting case is in the second chapter of Acts. In the second chapter of Acts, in the RSV, we have Peter quoting from the Old Testament. We read there in verses 25 to 32, where he's Peter speaking of the resurrection, starting with 24, I guess. He said, "But God raised him up, having loosed the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him, 'I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand, that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. Moreover, my flesh shall dwell in hope, for thou wilt not abandon my soul to Hades, nor let thy Holy One see corruption.'" And verse 29, he says, "Brethren, I may say to you confidently of the patriarch David, he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." And David predicted Jesus' resurrection by these words. Now a key phrase in it is, "Nor let thy Holy One see corruption." Certainly. And there is a footnote which refers you there to Psalm 16:10. I don't think the RSV, so-called Holy Bible, will be quite as unholy as it is if they didn't put all these footnotes in referring you to the Old Testament passage. Because you can immediately see what they're quoting and see how different. It makes it quite obvious that this is not a Holy Bible if their translation were the correct translation. You turn to Psalm 16, and there you read in verse 10 that he says, "For thou dost not give me up to Sheol, nor let thy godly one see the pit." And pit has a capital P. Well, why should you put a capital P on the word pit? I don't know, there's no reason for that, unless you think there is something very, very remarkable about this word pit. Well, it so happens that the Hebrew word shachat is a word that occurs maybe 20 times in the Old Testament. And there are two of these cases where it refers very evidently to a hole that is made in the ground and then covered over with grass and little branches so it can catch an animal. And it says the man that digs the shachat will fall into himself. And it speaks of the pit that way as the snare that is put there so that something will fall into it and you can catch it. And the wicked lay a pit for the light to fall into. But there are only two or three cases where it has that meaning. There are no more cases where it can be proven to have that meaning. The Septuagint version, the Greek translation made about 200 B.C., translated in just two or three cases as pit. But in all the other cases, it translated either as death or as corruption or some synonym. Corruption, destruction, death. That is what the Septuagint translated it in the overwhelming majority of cases. Jews in 200 B.C. who were a lot closer to the knowledge of Hebrew than anybody would be today. today. That's the way they translated that word. Well, now, why should one word have two such different meanings as corruption or destruction and a hole in the ground for an animal to fall into? Why should it have two such distinct meanings? Well, I mentioned yesterday the case of our English word light, which is used in two very different meanings. A big book can be light if it's light color. The little one can be light if it's easier to carry. Entirely distinct meanings because they come from two entirely different sources. Now, in this case, there is a Hebrew word, shahat, which means to become corrupt, from which you can derive the noun shahat, corruption or death or destruction. And there's also a Hebrew word, shuat, a far less common word, which means to dig. In fact, it's never used in its primary form. But there are secondary forms derived from shuat, a few of them, meaning dig. And so it's easy to see how you can get the noun shakat. The at is frequently an ending on a noun. How you can get shakat from shuat, dig, as they did in two or three cases without question. But it is also easy to see how you can get shakat to mean corruption or destruction from shahat, which is quite a frequent word to mean to destroy or become corrupt. That's easy to see how you can get both of those. Now, the Brown, Driver, and Briggs is the best Hebrew dictionary I know of, even though it's about 60 years old. And the reason it is because it gives full detail. Under every meaning that it gives all the instances except extremely common words. And when you see it giving a meaning with only two instances, you'd better look them up for yourself and see it. There is really evidence that it has those meanings. Like if there are only two cases that shakat, two or three that shakat means a pit, well, you look them up and find that they dig a pit that the animal can fall into it, or they dig a pit for the righteous man to fall into it. Well, that's perfectly clear that means dig. No question. But in many cases, the context doesn't tell you. And there, if those modernists make a guess, if they have a lot of cases where they make the same guess, you can probably take a pretty good chance that they're correct. If you want to be sure, check them all. Now, there's a more recent German dictionary called Kirler Baumgartner, and people think it's far more scholarly to follow these recent scholars who only died within the last 10 years. Kirler and Baumgartner than to follow Brown, Driver, and Briggs of 60 years ago. But Kirler and Baumgartner simply give you the Hebrew word, and then they give you the German word they think it means. And that's only their opinion. They don't give you the evidence. Brown, Driver gives you the evidence, and you can make your own judgment. So I think Brown, Driver, and Briggs, though it's older, is far, far better. Far more dependable. And worst of all, Kirler Baumgartner has an English translation of the German word. And some fool has recently published a book in English giving the Hebrew word with the English translation found in Kirler Baumgartner of the German word which they give to translate the Hebrew word. Well, now you see that's two stages removed. And all it gives is the word without any proof that's what it means. And I wish that all those copies were destroyed. They are valuable to refer you to discussions in magazines. That is the big killer bomber. Discussions that have occurred in the last 30 years in magazines of the meaning of a word. But most people who don't look up those discussions. Or you even use this English book that merely gives an English translation of the German and often a mistranslation of the German, which may in many cases be a mistranslation of the Hebrew. So I believe the book is a very, very unfortunate thing, which unfortunately people who like to think of themselves as scholars today are using all over the country instead of using Brown, Driver, and Briggs, which gives you the material on which to see what the evidence is for the meaning. Now, shuat does mean to dig. There are two or three clear cases. but it's not a common word. And Shaketh may be a pit, but there are only two or three cases where the context makes it short. What Brown, Ryder, and Bray in this particular case translates all uses of Shaketh as pit, which is, in my opinion, utter nonsense. And the Revised Standard Version does the same thing. And so wherever it says he will bring me down to death, they say he'll bring me down to the pit. And then they put pit with a capital P. And then one recent Bible dictionary made the statement, said that in Jewish and Christian theology, the pit was thought of as the lowest part of Sheol. Well, I don't know what they based such an idea on. Maybe some philosophers thought that there was a separate part of Sheol, which is called the pit with a capital P. But there's no evidence whatever in the Bible of that. And to take this word that 200 B.C. was considered to mean corruption or destruction, and interpreters as always meaning the pit with a capital P, is utter and utter nonsense. That is what is done in the RSV. But in this particular case, you see the evil it does. Somebody reads, Peter says, this is what we would expect, that he'd be raised from the dead. Because David said that your Holy One won't see corruption. And then you look back and you see, they say in the psalm, your Holy One won't see the pit, and that's the lowest part of hell. And a good man like Jesus, even if he wasn't God, wouldn't see the lowest part of hell. So it has nothing in the world to do with a resurrection. And a person reading the RSV would say, what fool Peter was, and those people there who listened to him and heard such an argument based on a misinterpretation of the Old Testament. Now, actually, it is a correct interpretation. Shaketh, with the meaning death or corruption, occurs far more often than meaning a pit that an animal might fall in, far more commonly. And it may be that the translator of the RSV said, well, Shaketh must come from Shuach. If pit, you couldn't have two words Shaketh, one of them meaning the pit, and the other meaning corruption, one from Shuach and one from Shaphat. You couldn't have such a thing. Well, could you? My former colleague, Dr. R. Laird Harris, came across. I don't know whether he discovered it himself or whether he read it somewhere, but I got it from him, and I was tremendously interested. The fact that he found that there's a verb, just like shaketh, there's a verb naketh, which means to go down. And just like shuach, there's a verb nuach, which means to rest. And from both of these, there's a noun naketh. So naketh from nuach would mean to rest, or a resting place, and naketh from the hat would mean a going down. And the RSV itself in Isaiah 30 translates Naketh once as a going down and once as the rest. So they recognize that Naketh and Nuach could have a noun derived from meaning, having two different meanings depending on the two roots, but deny the possibility with Shaketh, where it affects their refusal to do so makes Peter out a liar. Well, that clock is going pretty fast, and maybe I will omit one or two other illustrations from the RSV. I have thought of going on to speak of the King James. The King James Version, which was issued in 1611, made its way over other versions and eventually displaced them all. It was a very excellent translation. I mentioned yesterday why it was an excellent translation. One reason, they were good scholars who made it. But they didn't call it a translation, they called it a revision. They revised the version that had been made by Tyndale over 100 years before. And Tyndale laid the foundation. And 3/4 of the words in the King James are taken verbatim from Tyndale's translation. 3/4 of the words. And Tyndale, who was persecuted for his faith and eventually killed for it, Tyndale worked out a system of translation which had a stately, beautiful type of language, hardly to be paralleled in other languages. Although the English language was, as a beautiful language, far superior in that century to anything it has been since. But Tyndale worked out this type of translation, and Coverdale made certain improvements at certain places following the same system. The Bishop's Bible, so-called, made certain other improvements. The Geneva Bible, published at Geneva, made many great improvements, even though, as I say, 3/4 of it is still word for word Tyndale. But the Geneva made other improvements. And even the Roman Catholic Bible made friends. Even that made a few improvements, though there were many points where it's not nearly so good. But the King James translators had all these in front of them, and in the front of speech, they even said, with comparison with the German, they had Martin Luther's translation before them also. And from these, and from their own literary ability, they made a translation which, as language, is one of the great masterpieces of history. The stateliness of the King James Version is the reason why it replaced all other versions. It is a good, accurate version. Yeah. But that's not the reason it replaced the Geneva Version, which was probably just as accurate. It is because of the beauty of its language. Somebody has said of it, consider, for instance, the effect of the long row of dactyls in this sentence. Who hath believed our report, and to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? Beautiful sentence. Now, of course, it is not quite an accurate sentence in present-day English. Who has believed our report? What's a report? Is it your report card? Is it something you're going to tell me? The Hebrew is, who has believed what we have heard? These men aren't talking about what they're going to tell. They're talking about what they have heard. Some people, some commentaries even say, Isaiah 53:1, this is the prophet speaking. Who has believed the report we've given? That's not what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew is very clear. Who has believed what we have heard? But that's not near as pretty English. And the King James Version has, while keeping the meaning on the whole very accurate, has put it into beautiful English. That is the English of 300 years ago. Beautiful English. And it is a masterpiece of English thought. Partly because of the excellence of the scholars who made it, but more particularly because they had Tyndale as a basis, who was a great genius in translation and the use of the English language, and because of the other translations that they were able to follow and to pick from this one and that one at different phrases. First of a phrase or something to make it into beautiful, stately, flowing English. It was a beautiful piece of work, and it was very fine that for 200 years it should be the Bible of the English speaking world. But today, its language is out of date. And those of us who, like myself, were brought up on it just love it, crazy, even when we don't understand it. But the young people today are not brought up on it, they don't understand it. They need a Bible in their own language. Now, there's some people who think of the King James Bible as almost an idol. They feel that any diversion from it is dangerous. I would like to say to them that the King James Version, though an excellent version, has its errors. There is no question. I could point out errors in the Old Testament. I could point out errors in the New Testament.
It is absolutely inexcusable that where earlier English versions had translated the commandment, thou shalt not murder, they changed it to thou shalt not kill. The Hebrew does not say thou shalt not kill. The Hebrew commands the killing of animals for sacrifices. It permits the killing of animals for meat. It gives regulations for war. It orders specifically that murderers are to be killed. To take it as thou shalt not kill is a mistranslation and not the meaning of the word. But great misunderstanding has come in through the use of that word. And I ask the Scofield Committee to change it to the new Scofield. But they said, oh, we cannot tamper with the people of these Ten Commandments. So there's not even a person who still has that mistranslation of that thou shalt not kill. The new Scofield, I was able to persuade them to make many changes in words, and not a tremendous one, just about one little page. It doesn't make a great deal, but it does make it possible to understand a lot of words that just don't make any sense to us today. But when I mentioned that, it was about to cut the art up. Well, I'm not going to take time, as I intended to review the first part of Isaiah 21. But let me just briefly say that Isaiah 29 describes the condition of Jerusalem with the Sennacherib's army of invasion approaching, a condition of misery. And then it suddenly changes to the relief that God brought when he caused that Sennacherib's army, the great bulk of them, should die, and Sennacherib had to give up the siege to go back to his homeland. Now, at that place in the King James Version, it says when they woke him, in the historical book, it says when they woke in the morning, they were all dead men. And, of course, that is a comical translation. There it means when some of them woke up, they found the others were all dead men. But in Isaiah 29, it does not describe the event. It poetically depicts the situation. And you have three or four verses that describe the situation. And then it says, moreover, the host of those that oppose you shall be like small dust, and so on. And it describes the destruction. And the Hebrew word and, they translate there, moreover. Now, the Hebrew word and is a word that is far broader than our English word. It's translated a dozen different ways in the Old Testament. But that is the most unfortunate. Moreover, it sounds as if he still continues reading the situation. And if I had plenty of time, I'd read you Isaiah 29, the first 8 verses, and very few of you get any sense. And then I'd read it again and simply change, moreover, they shall be to however they shall become, and the whole thing becomes bright and clear. Now that is an unfortunate error in the King James Version. The translation of wow as moreover. A very unfortunate error in the King James Version is the translation of agape. The Greek word agape, in a few cases, as charity. Charity suffers long and is kind, and so on. That wonderful 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, reduced to meaninglessness to people today by putting the word charity in it. They don't say God is charity. The Bible says God is love, and it's exactly the same word. In the overwhelming majority of cases, they translate agape, love, and this was done in 1 Corinthians 13 in earlier versions. I don't know what struck them to put charity in there, but to me, it is a terrible flaw in the King James Version, the translation of love by charity. Now, there are cases where the tenses are erroneous, and where they have confused people,
I do not have time to look at two instances that I was going to mention that would take a bit of time to enter them in detail. But there's one that I'm going to mention to you. It is Isaiah 53, the last chapter. And in Isaiah 53, the last chapter, as it reads in the King James Version, it says, at the end of the verse says, because he has poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bears the sin of men. What more do you need to say? He poured out his, because he has poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bears the sin of men. There's the atonement clearly stated. What is added by saying, and made intercession for the transgressor? Well, that's not an argument, the fact that it doesn't seem to us to make sense. We want to find the sense of it in the Bible. But in the Bible, you have the past tense. He poured out his soul unto death. He was numbered with the transgressor. He bears the sin of many. And then it switches tense to a tense that is quite usually translated as future. And if you translate it literally, it would be, and he will make intercession for the transgressor. And so here you have in this last verse of chapter 53 a description of the atonement of Christ with three phrases explaining it fully, and then it ends with the statement that he will make intercession for the transgressor through the ages to come. Jesus sitting at the right hand of God making intercession for us. It is an added thought, not merely a repetition of what's already been stated in three phrases. The change of tense is definite in it. If they simply mistranslated because they failed to note the great Christian truth change in this verse. Now, the King James Version, the greatest scholar of the day, whose name was Hugh Rowson, was not invited to work on it. They said he was a hard man to work with. When it finished, they asked him what he thought of it. And the King asked to send a message to Hugh Rowson. What do you think of the new translations these men I appointed to make? He said, tell His Majesty I'd rather be rent in pieces with wild horses than any such translation by my consent should be urged upon the poor churches. That's what the greatest scholar of the day thought of the King James Version. Now, I think he was wrong. I think a good part of it was piqued that they didn't ask him to work with them on it. But it certainly is a good evidence against idolizing the King James Version. It was a wonderful version, and for 200 years it served the world well. For the last 100 years it has served Christian people well, but has been an impediment in the way of evangelizing those who did not have a Christian background. The principal reason why the King James Version is now out of date is that the English language has changed. Paul says, I do you to wit. And what on earth does he mean? Well, you can easily guess from the context. But that's not the purpose of a translation. You might as well say bang a bang a bang. If you're just going to put in sounds and then you guess from the context what it is. The Greek says, I want you to know. And in the time of King James, a good way to say I want you to know is I do you to wit. The people were interested in Luke 15:32. The prodigal son came back and he found that they had killed the fatted calf for his brother, and he objected to the father, and the father said, it's meat. It is meat. Well, of course, anybody knows the fatted calf is meat. But he goes on to say, it's meat that I should do something for your brother who was away, was lost, and now is found. We don't use meat in that sense today, but it occurred a good many times in the King James Version. And for a person who's not raised on this language, you might look as well as say bangity bang. And for many who have been raised on it, they don't know what it means. We are told in Psalm 5:6 that the Lord will destroy all those that speak leasing. Does this mean that all the real estate brokers are going to be destroyed? How many people here even know what's meant by leasing? It's old English for lying. But very few people know it. Where the word froward is used a good bit. Hardly anybody today knows what froward means. Where it says that the sun goes in, the King James paraphrases it quite rightly by saying the sun went down. It's not what the Hebrew says, it's a paraphrase. But it's quite excusable. It's the term we use today. But where it says that Abraham was going in years, which would be quite understandable to us, and would be a literal translation, the King James says he was, where the Hebrew says he's going in the days. The Hebrew says he was well stricken in years. Now that's an old English idiom. We know what it means, but it's a paraphrase. I tried to get the Schofield translation to change where he says, I trauma. How many people today know what it means, I trauma? But one member of the committee said any fair person will know what that means. So that's one of the cases where I was not successful in getting the change made. It speaks of people being sore afraid. We don't talk that way today. We can guess what it means. But where it says God tempted Abraham, and James says that God does not tempt any man, then it says God tempted Abraham. I had a big fight over that in the committee. We changed the text, which is, of course, what it means. I said, I don't say that my students bring paper and pencil to class and won't tempt you today. But to the average person that you're trying to lead to understand the Christian truth, it is an injury to have to use old language. Suffer me, he said. Well, who wants to tell somebody to suffer? Peter said, suffer me to wash your feet. Well, permit. Use present-day English. We need a translation in the English of today. It is not right to make the King James Version into an idol. Now, the one thing that people do not realize is how difficult it is in print to keep from having misprints. It is very difficult to prevent misprints. But the King James Version, the first two issues of it, had over 200 different places where they differ because it is so difficult to get typed exactly correct. In almost any book you read, if you're careful, you will see misprints that come in. Now, these misprints can first be injurious. Now, there was a translation, there was a publication of the King James Bible that said, let the children first be killed. It was just a clip of K instead of an F. It was let the children first be killed, which it should have been. There was another publication of it that said, printers have persecuted me without a cause. It was printers have persecuted me. I don't know whether the man who was setting type had something against his fellow printers or not, but I'm sure it was subconscious of it was. And there was one issue of several hundred copies of the King James Version that were issued, and after it was issued, they were shocked to find that in the seventh commandment, the printer left out the word not, so they made the commandment, thou shalt commit adultery. The first copy of the first edition of the King James Bible spoke of Ruth going into the city and said she went in. It spoke of Boaz from the city, said he went to the city. The next two editions of it said she went to the city. And so if you get a copy of the original King James Bible from 1611, which would be very expensive today to get, immediately they will say, this is a great He Bible, or this is a great She Bible. And that means whether it says Ruth went into the city or Boaz, because there's that difference. The Hebrew manuscripts are half and half. We don't know which is the Hebrew. I think in the context, B is what it should be. But I believe that now they printed she, there's slightly more evidence in manuscript for she than he. Where it says that the dog licked up his blood about Ahab, one publication said the dog liked his blood instead of the dog licked up his blood. And one error where the Greek word is to filter. They speak of filtering something. They made a good translation of filter as strain out. But the printer got it strain at. And so it says you strain at a gnat and follow a camel. Now there's a misprint in the first publication of the King James Bible that has been copied to the present day. So it is purely a misprint from the first issue. The Greek is definitely to strain out or to filter. But he says to strain at a gnat and follow a camel. It gives us quite a different idea. But that misprint that came in has just been copied as proofreaders have compared the new edition with the old to try to get rid of mistakes before they ran it off on the press. They just copied it exactly. And this original misprint is here today. Now that simply shows how very difficult it is to copy these, even to make a printed book that is exactly correct. It is very, very difficult. Now the Bible was copied and recopied and recopied and recopied for 2,000 years. And the marvel is that the Bible, as the copies that sleepy Byzantine monks had made through the centuries to fulfill their required stint of work. These copies, hundreds of years after the original, do not introduce any false doctrine, but are true to the ideas of the original. That is a marvelous thing. And yet some people try to make out that the result of copying, 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 copying like that is more correct than the original first copy. And so the final copies of manuscripts just before they started making books came 50 years after the King, or 20 years after the King James Version was issued, to be called the Textus Receptus. And it's a beautiful Latin phrase. And some people today say the Textus Receptus is the original Bible. You might as well say, if the King James Version is good enough for St. Paul, it's good enough for us. I have a little pamphlet about the Textus Receptus, which Mr. Taylor just brought a bunch of in. I didn't intend it to bring it in until tomorrow. I didn't talk about that a bit tomorrow. But if some of you want to take one today, I won't object, so they're intended for tomorrow.